According to Charlie Cobb, the story of what became known as Freedom Summer could use an introduction and more detail. His new book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, is subtitled How Guns Made the Nonviolent Civil Rights Movement Possible. But it's more than a book about the role of firearms. It's an informative prequel to the summer of 1964. I had a chance to speak with Cobb, who was in Mississippi as a field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, also known as SNCC. I began by asking him to describe who paved the way for the civil rights activism of the 1960s.
In the aftermath of World War II, what you really see is a change in the climate made by black veterans, for the most part, who had been overseas fighting against Nazism, fighting against Japanese and Italian fascism. And these soldiers came back changed because of all of this and far less willing to accept white supremacy. And that change in attitude leads directly, I think, to the civil rights movement as we've come to know it in the 1950s and 1960s.
You illuminate the role of the NAACP and the RCNL in the years prior to 1964. Why were those organizations important?
Young people were from SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and CORE, the Congress for Racial Equality, were a driving force in the 1964 summer project, Freedom Summer. I mean, we were really standing on the shoulders of an older generation, many of whom come out of, as I said, World War II. So what you see is, for instance, the NAACP, really by mid-20th century, is beginning to emphasize the rights of citizenship. A lot of the early NAACP activity was anti-lynching, for example. Now, by the 1950s, I mean, it's clear to the NAACP is challenging school segregation, you know, saying that we are, black people, are citizens, and we don't have to prove anything when it comes to the rights of citizenship. And one manifestation of this changed attitude is the Regional Council of Negro Leadership, RCNL. The Regional Council of Negro Leadership was largely, had many, many black veterans in it. And two, it was waging in Mississippi, particularly in the Mississippi Delta, a fight to gain the full rights of citizenship. And many of the leaders of the RCNL, Aaron Henry, a World War II veteran and later to become state president of the NAACP, Amzie Moore, a local NAACP leader and also a World War II veteran, Medgar Evers, who would become the NAACP's state field secretary in Mississippi, the first state field secretary in Mississippi, they formed the leadership of the RCNL, and they also were the grown-ups who encouraged our presence as SNCC and CORE in Mississippi. So you can see a kind of relationship between these guys, and they were mostly men, as veterans, as NAACP leaders and activists, and as people who were welcoming to the young people of SNCC and CORE.
You talk about the powerful gun culture in the South, weak gun control laws that enabled blacks to arm with relative ease. Did the Mississippi Sovereignty Commission and the White Citizens Council, these organizations that stepped up after Brown versus Board of Education, did they put anything in gear to prevent blacks from owning guns?
No. They tried. One legislator tried to introduce gun control legislation, but the gun culture was too powerful. I mean, guns are just too routine in the South. They could never, there's no real interest in trying to disarm black. That attempt had been made after the Civil War in the Reconstruction era, where state law attempted to disarm blacks. But in the 1950s and 60s, I'd have to say, no, guns were relatively easy to acquire, although it would have been more difficult for blacks, A, to acquire automatic weapons, and B, to gain a license to carry a concealed weapon. and you could see some differences there. But when it comes to shotguns, pistols, blacks and whites were treated pretty much the same. I doubt that groups like the Sovereignty Commission, which was a spy agency, or the White Citizens Council, which was kind of, as one historian said, a group that bore the face of the Rotary Club, even if it encouraged Klan-like violence. These people weren't riding around at night and facing direct danger from black gunfire the way Ku Klux Klan members would be.
Who were the Deacons for Defense and Justice, and how effective were they?
Well, I think the Deacons for Defense and Justice in Louisiana first arose in Jonesboro, Louisiana, which is North Louisiana, or as they say in Louisiana, the top of the boot, one of the more Klan-ridden parts of Louisiana, very rural. And they essentially emerged to protect nonviolent core workers who were organizing around voter registration and, in fact, unlike in Mississippi, engaged in some direct action protests against segregation and public accommodation. And these were a group of men, older men, and largely Korean War or World War II veterans, again, who decided they would not allow core workers to be harmed by Ku Klux Klan violence. So they were armed and they were organized. And their very existence really kept violence directed at core workers to a minimum. You won't find in looking at the Deacons for Defense and Justice the kind of aggressive attacks on their part. They were purely an organization engaged in self-defense. And as was true in other parts of the South when it came to armed groups, that was pretty much enough to keep marauders away, because as much as these people in the Ku Klux Klan or in other groups proclaimed their commitment to white supremacy, none of them were prepared to die for it.
History tends to get romanticized. Do you describe the SNCC and Corps shock troops being a romantic image?
That became a part of the narrative, the public narrative.
Right.
You know, and I'm critical of this public narrative, you know, which sure reduces the Southern freedom movement to the most simplistic of components. And one of these simplistic components was of rugged, ragged SNCC and Corps field workers taking on mad dog sheriffs and crazed Ku Klux Klan members. I mean, that was a romance that has been built into the narrative, which is really not completely true. I mean, SNCC and Corps people were human beings and responded to their situations as best they could and as best that any human being would respond.
You make a strong case for the risk that Mississippians took being lost in this story. And you also describe how important ground-level community organizing was and how that piece of the story also gets missed in this larger romantic image.
What has happened is that the Southern freedom movement has been reduced to the idea of mass protests in public spaces being led by charismatic leaders. And in my view, the real story of the Southern freedom movement is grassroots community organizing, often invisible in rural, out-of-the-way places, in the backwoods. And Julian Bond quipped, When we were talking about this, as I was really just beginning the book, and he says, yeah, the public narrative of the civil rights movement has been reduced to one sentence. Rosa sat down, Martin stood up, and then the white folks saw the light and saved the day. This is an oversimplistic view, and really people in the United States is not very good with history to start with. It doesn't matter whether it's civil rights history or history of the American Revolution. And so we have a incomplete portrait of what the Southern freedom movement was. And I try and correct some of that in this book.
That was Charlie Cobb, a journalist, professor, and former field secretary for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. His book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed, was published in June. For WYSO's Community Voices, I'm Dave Barber.